Good morning and welcome to Girona. We begin now the second workshop, Oxford, Girona, on legal philosophy. Be more hospitable with our guests. I want to thank Professors Finnish, Andy Kurt and Paul Brady to having accepted our invitation so nicely. This year, the Oxford-Girona meeting is also a meeting between authors and discussants of the natural law tradition and objectivism in morals and the positivist tradition or legal realist. Relativistic in morals. So we hope and expect to have interesting discussions. Finally, the Professor Finnish is, I think, a paradigmatic case of a scholar that does not need presentation. So I do not try to invest any more time in anything unnecessary and devote directly the word to him. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Rector. Well, it's a great pleasure for me, and I know for my colleagues as well, to be here in Girona, in some sense representing Oxford. What you will see today is, so to speak, at least three generations of Oxford legal philosophy. I came to Oxford to study legal philosophy in 1962 to be one of H.L.A. Hart's graduate students, and Professor Endicott came to Oxford in 1991 to study legal philosophy. And Paul Brady came 3 or 4 years ago, again to study legal philosophy in Oxford. When I came, the Oxford legal philosophy community, professors and students, all together perhaps amounted to 10 people. There was Hart. There was no other professor dedicated to legal theory, although Professor Honoré and Professor Simpson and a few others practiced in or around the edges of it. And there were just three or four of us doctoral students in legal philosophy, amongst them Joseph Raz, who came the year after I did. So you see here, so to speak, 50 years of Oxford legal philosophy, and 50 years in which it has greatly, greatly thrived, because the community of which Andrea Dolcetti and Ben Spagnuolo and Paul Brady are a part is many times larger than 10. And I myself had the pleasure of my first, so to speak, Catalan doctoral student, Maris Kerpke-Tintere, who was a predecessor of Paul in the vibrant jurisprudence discussion group, and the existence of a jurisprudence discussion group entirely managed by graduates like her or Paul or Ben is something that has been a wonderful innovation and something for us all to be proud of. And so I'm very glad that both the first Oxford-Girona event and now this second one had the structure that they have, namely a professor or two and then some real live students, and that's truly representative of Oxford. Now, I sent in advance, and I think you have seen not a paper, but some notes towards the theme that I want to discuss with you this morning, to which I gave the aggressive title Contemporary Positivist Theories of Law, scare quotes, are natural law theories. In some ways, this title is unrepresentative of the current state of thought in Oxford legal philosophy, because it's widely accepted amongst us now that such labels, descriptions as positivist or natural law theorist, are best avoided, are unsatisfactory gestures towards complex clusters of positions. But for simplification, I've used these labels, and I will not stand by them resolutely if they are challenged. And when I myself came to look at the notes that I sent you again last night, I thought that the second sentence, if not the first, I thought the first sentence was probably correct. The second sentence was probably incorrect. But let's look at it bit by bit. Legal theorists, I say, who present or understand their theories as positivist, or as instances of legal positivism, assume that their theories are opposed to, or at least clearly distinct from, natural law theory. And I think that is true. I mean, if someone describes himself or herself as a positivist, he intends to make the point that he doesn't subscribe to something else, and usually that something else would be natural law theory. Natural law theorists, on the other hand, I said, do not conceive, and I said did not conceive, their theories in opposition to or even as distinct from legal positivism. Now, as I say, I think that sentence needs significant qualification. When I wrote it, for the purposes of the article in the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, in which I was asked to write on natural law theories of law, when I wrote it, I had in my mind the kind of theory which one finds developed in Thomas Aquinas and subsequently and expounded in my own work. And what I say here is, I think, true of that theory, that that way of understanding law is not conceived in opposition to positivism or something of that sort. Rather, Aquinas or I discuss positive law, identify the need for positive law, discourse about what it is for law to be positive, demonstrate the desirability of positivity, without, I might say, any anxiety. But if one goes back to the origins of legal philosophy, I think it probably is not the case that natural law theorists did not conceive their theories in opposition to legal positivism. I wrote something about this in an article on natural law theory for a French encyclopedia and then subsequently a Chinese one. Those of you who have read it in Chinese will perhaps excuse me if I remind you of its contents in English. And I said there, the link between contemporary and classical legal theory or philosophy can be traced back as far as the Greek world of the 6th and 5th centuries before Christ. The surviving fragments of the pre-Socratics suggest a vigorous debate, which today, however, cannot be securely reconstructed. The accessible conversation of Western legal theory or Western legal philosophy really begins with two brief dialogues reflecting the debates in Socratic circles. A witty conversation put on the lips of the Athenian politicians Alcibiades and Pericles by Xenophon in his Memorabilia, and a Socratic dialogue insecurely ascribed to Plato, the Minos. Each of these two portrays the embarrassments awaiting philosophers who define law as whatever is decreed by rulers, and who neglect or decline to refer to issues of moral right, such as whether the law's subjects have in any way consented to it, which is the issue that Xenophon's dialogue takes up, or whether the law decrees is good or true or in conformity with what really is, which is what the Minos focuses upon. Both these dialogues suggest that although everyone understands the sense in which a law's justice or injustice is irrelevant to its empirical reality as enforced, there is nevertheless good reason to say that in a more adequate understanding of law, unjust laws are, and now here is the expression used in the Minos, more a matter of force than of law. And again, are not without qualification law. So we see by the early 4th century two positions emerging, each of which is, you could say, still defended in contemporary legal philosophy. Modern legal positivism asserts that to be described with realism and clarity, law must be considered without regard to any moral predicates which it attracts in discourse outside the philosophy of law, for example, in moral political evaluation. On the other hand, natural law theory, so-called, asserts that such a description of law misses the point of law. Legal systems, on this view, get their sense and shape, which a good descriptive account of law will identify. They get their sense and shape from their point. And a rational evaluation of particular laws or legal systems or political communities will use that perhaps complex point purpose as a criterion for measuring their conformity to or deviation from the very idea of law. And Plato articulated this second position when he says, for example, in the Laws in 715b, enactments, to the extent that they are not for the common interest of the whole community, are not truly laws. And he says something to the same effect in the Statesman. Cicero summed up the view that was, and until the 19th century remained, the philosophical mainstream, when he says, in the very definition of the term law, I think he says jus, there inheres the idea and principle of choosing what is just and true. That's from the De Legibus. On this issue of definition, Plato warned us that ordinary talk of law is one thing, but explanatory definition of law is another thing again, something else. And the two ways of speaking coexist. In the Hippias Major, he has Socrates say, "When would-be lawmakers miss the good, they have missed law and legality." What do you say, says Socrates to Hippias. Hippias says, "Speaking precisely, that is so, but people don't usually put it that way." So Plato's claim is that a more precise understanding of law leads you to say something along the lines of an unjust law fails to be really law. But, of course, people don't commonly say that, and people commonly don't say that for good reasons, for intelligible reasons. The law that's unjust, and in that sense is a failure as law, nonetheless is enforced, is spoken of as law. You can read it in law books. The court sitting here will impose it on the defendant, and in many senses it's law, legality. So Aristotle worked out the appropriate account of definition in social, including legal theory, to handle this duality of ways of speaking. On the one hand, there is pure description or reportage. This and this purport to be and are commonly called friendships, political communities, constitutions, citizenship, laws. And that pure description can coexist with explanatory definition within a theory which treats justification and, where appropriate, critical delegitimation as the primary mode of explanation. Thus, the humanly good type of friendship, or community, or constitution, or law, is the paradigm, the central case, picked out by the explanatory definition, and picked out also by a corresponding word, friendship, or law, in its focal meaning. Specimens of this good type are in this sense truly, properly, or unqualifiedly, haplos, or in Latin, simpliciter, simpliciter, friendship, or law, etc. But instances of a type that is humanly deficient, unjust, remain within the discipline's philosophical account, precisely as analogous to the central case. The philosophy of human affairs, to use Aristotle's phrase, as it bears on law, as it relates to law, as it looks at law, reflects on decent laws and legal systems with, however, due attention to what makes laws bad, and attention to how bad laws, in what ways bad laws matter. And then to finish up, I say, until Jeremy Bentham, foreshadowed in the 14th century by Ockham and Marsilius of Padua, and then in the 17th century by Bacon and Hobbes and Spinoza, until Bentham, there is little or no specifically legal philosophy which could be called positivist. And so when I wrote what I wrote in the second sentence of what I sent you, I was thinking as if I were in the period from, well, somewhere after Aristotle down to Bentham. Now, what you have in these notes that I sent you, which I just began with, is three sets of things. First, the remarks I made in this article in the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, which include two elements, some reflections at the beginning, on the first page or two, about the relationship between natural law theory and opposing theories, and then some pages about what a natural law theory does, the course it follows in developing its own kind of theory of law. And then on page 7 or so, 7, I give you three quotations from contemporary theorists in Oxford, as it happens, who are willing to describe themselves, if not keen to describe themselves, as positivists. And then finally, on page 9, a few quotations from a previous generation of positivists represented by Hans Kelsen. And the point of my remarks is to suggest to you something for reflection and discussion, that the kind of conception of legal theory that you find represented in Kelsen, by Kelsen's work from its beginning in 1911 to its end in the end of the 1960s, is a conception of legal theory which has been decisively abandoned by, you might say, his successors. And the process of abandonment is already well underway in the work of H.L.A. Hart, in The Concept of Law, in the essays on Bentham, and so forth, and is clearly carried to its conclusion, this process of abandonment of Kelsen's conception, is carried to its conclusion in the work of Raz and Green and Gardner. On the first page, you see my observations about these contemporary theorists such as Raz, Green, and Gardner, and you see my qualification in the footnote number 2, in which I retract what I had said in the last paragraph on the first page. I said in the original article, in this last paragraph, I said contemporary positivist theories are, it seems, natural law theories, distinguished from the main body of natural law theory, first by their denial that the theory of law, as distinct from the theory or theories of adjudication, of judicial duty, of citizens' allegiance, obligation, etc., their denial that the theory of law necessarily or most appropriately deals with the related matters just listed, adjudication, duty, allegiance, obligation. And secondly, characterized by the incompleteness of their theories of law, that is, the absence from them, and usually, though not always, from their accounts of those related matters, the absence from them of systematic critical attention to the foundations of the moral or other normative claims that they make or presuppose. So, when I was writing that paragraph, I was thinking of what I took to be, or am inclined still to take to be, the position that, say, Joseph Raz occupied through most of his career in legal theory, in which the theory of law is characterized by the sources thesis. And the sources thesis says, as articulated by Raz, that all rules of law, all the content of the law, is given exclusively, entirely, by reference to social fact sources, facts such as enactment or judgment by courts with precedential authority. That was the theory of law, and then there was a theory of adjudication in which Raz would say, the court has the duty, the judges have the duty, the moral duty to do justice. And where justice requires departing from the law, that's what judges in certain circumstances, under certain conditions, with certain provisos, should do. So when I was writing that paragraph, I was thinking, well, there's the theory of law, entirely demarcated by the sources thesis, and in that respect, in the old language, strictly positivist. And then there's the theory of adjudication, as conceived by Raz, which is moralistic, moralizing, with a theory of justice or a fragment of an ethics and political philosophy of a moralizing kind. But I am now obliged to write the footnote qualifying that, or partly withdrawing it, if not wholly withdrawing it, by the fact that as you see on page 7, the quotation from Raz, he says now, a theory of law, is, among other things, a theory of the conditions, if any, under which the law is morally legitimate, and of the consequences that follow from the assumption that it is morally legitimate. Our interest in legal authority lies in how it establishes the moral authority of the law, or of parts of it. We are interested in the authority of the law, if any, in order to establish whether we have an obligation to respect and obey it. And by obligation there, he clearly means a moral obligation. So Raz, in his late work, which I am quoting from late period, recent period work, articulated in his new book, Between Authority and Interpretation, and this comes from a component of the book which is more recent than some other components of it. Raz, in his late and recent work, conceives of legal theory seamlessly, so to speak, as moralistic or moralizing or concerned with justice and the moral good, what I call decency, etc., from beginning to end. Though somewhere in it there remains the sources thesis. And if you then turn over the page to look at the passage from, or the summary, the paraphrase that I give of John Gardner's articulation of what is positivism in his well-known article, Legal Positivism, 5.5 Myths, from 2001, you have the picture of, first, a definition of law, or rather a definition of what it is for a law to be legally valid, called by him LP star, in any legal system, whether a given norm is legally valid, and hence whether it forms part of the law of that system, depends on its sources, not its merits. Where its merits in the relevant senses include the merits of its sources. So no reference to merits, entirely reference to sources. So that's his articulation of the sources thesis in the Razian sense. And it's his view that legal theory begins with this thought, LP star. But he goes on to say, LP star, that proposition, is not a whole theory of law's nature. It is a thesis about legal validity, which is compatible with any number of further theses about law's nature, including the thesis that all valid law is, by its nature, subject to special moral objectives and imperatives of its own, and so forth. So you have the rest of Gardner's position. Again, so one in which legal theory, the theory of law, our discipline, our discourse, is characterised by a moral concern, though containing within it a sources thesis which declares that the law consists exclusively of what can be identified by sources involving no reference to good or bad, right or wrong, what he calls compendiously the merits. And then finally you have the position of Green, which is essentially the same. He's writing an article on legal positivism in the Encyclopedia of the Sanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. He says legal positivism is the thesis that the existence and content of law depends on social facts and not on its merits. But at the end of the article, he reaches this position. Legal positivism, the theory, requires only that it be in virtue of its facticity, its social fact sources, rather than its meritoriousness, that something is law. And that we can describe that facticity without assessing its merits. That's all that legal positivism requires. But evaluative argument is central to the philosophy of law. More generally, no legal philosopher can be only a legal positivist. A complete theory of law requires also an account of what kinds of things could possibly count as merits of law. Must law be efficient or elegant as well as just? Of what role law should play in adjudication? Should valid law always be applied? Of what claim law has on our obedience? Is there a duty, understood a moral duty, to obey? And also of the pivotal questions of what laws we should have and whether we should have law at all. Legal positivism does not seek to answer these questions, although its claim that the existence and content of law depends only on social facts does give them the questions shape. So I think his picture, and I think this is Gardner's, is you need the definition of law given in the sources thesis to identify your subject matter. And then about the subject matter, you can ask all these questions. Whereas the account of law that I here call natural law theory, and that is expounded by Plato and Aristotle and Cicero and Aquinas and myself in our own works, reaches a definition of law only, so to speak, at the end of the inquiry. It takes, as Hart took in the concept of law, it takes for granted that we all understand the general range of data, of phenomena, which give rise to legal philosophy. We don't need a definition at that point. We understand the common use of the term law. We know that it refers to law courts and legislation and adjudication and taxation and documents of various kinds and professions of various kinds. That's all understood by us from our common language. It's as well known to the man in the street as it is well known to us, or it's as well known to our colleagues who have no interest in legal theory as it is to us. So we don't need a definition of law to begin reflection of the kind that counts as legal theory or legal philosophy. So a good legal philosophical definition of law will come at the end of our inquiry and will draw upon all those sources of reflection on the justifiability of law, the reasonable purposes, the possible purposes, the consequent structure of means for pursuit of these desirable or possible ends, when that has all been sifted, discoursed about, inquired into, then we can arrive at a definition in which the sources, the social fact sources, the positivity of law will play a very large role for the reasons that we will have discovered in our reflections on this set of data or phenomena. It's obvious that in the human situation, predicament, social life, we need certain kinds of social arrangement. And we need not simply Hart's primary rules, we need Hart's secondary rules. And we need Hart's secondary rules, just as Hart says, as a remedy for defects in the situation that would obtain in the absence of the secondary rules. And those defects to which law, positive law, is a response, include all the defects which Hart explicitly identifies in the concept of law, and also the defects which many of his readers, as they read his exposition of the defects of a set of purely primary rules, I think many of his readers, so to speak, read in something more. What more? He says, in a society without secondary rules of adjudication, disputes are not resolvable efficiently. Efficiently, that's his word. I think most of us, when we are reflecting, doing this essential moment of reflection which his book invites us to make on the defects of a society without law, most of us at that point think, well, the defect of the absence of courts, the absence of judicial power, the defect is not simply that disputes do not get resolved or do not get resolved quickly, efficiently in the sense of quickly, speedily. Rather, disputes do not get resolved justly, fairly, appropriately. So to get disputes resolved appropriately, which includes impartially, with a view to the truth about the facts, without bias, without bribery, to get that, we need rules of adjudication, identifying judges, not simply dispute resolvers. So at that point, the claims of justice, the moral claims of justice, enter into our understanding of what it is to be a remedy, what it is to be a law of the kind that Hart characterizes as a secondary rule of adjudication. And so at that moment, Hart departs or puts before us, a train on which we can board and depart from the position that Kelsen had occupied. Because if you read Kelsen's books from end to end, you find no discussion of these questions of the claims of justice as grounds for law, as reasons for having law, and as reasons for having laws of the kind of the structure that we actually characteristically have, and that Kelsen wishes to expound, and that Rouse wishes to expound, that Hart expounded, and so forth. So people have boarded that train, to use the Euro metaphor, and have travelled far away from the positions that you find expounded in that last set of quotations from Kelsen. And I think rightly so. If you just look for a moment at the passages of Kelsen that I picked out, which are, I believe, representative and central passages of Kelsen, you can see how, so to speak, primitive legal theory was as expounded by a sophisticated master of law such as Kelsen. Kelsen was a most sophisticated scholarly master of law, but the theory of law which he develops is of utmost crudity, gross oversimplification. Look at this, the last two quotations. The word law refers to a specific social technique which consists in bringing about the desired social conduct of men, of people, through the threat of a measure of coercion which is to be applied in case of contrary conduct. Page 19 of the General Theory of Law and State. If you read the paragraph around that and ask why does he articulate this position, the answer that he gives you is, this is the one thing common to all uses of the word law as applicable to the most primitive social situations all the way to the most sophisticated legal system. Because that is the one thing common, the use of coercion, that is what gives us our characterization of law for the purposes of legal theory. And then notice even more drastically the last quotation from page 45. If coercion, in the sense here defined, is an essential element of law, and that if is supplied by the passage on page 18, then the norms which form a legal order must be norms stipulating a coercive act, that is, a sanction. In particular, the general norms must be norms in which a certain sanction is made dependent upon certain conditions. And that gives you the entire content of Kelsen's nomodynamics, the structure, the element, gives you the complete set of elements of law for the purposes of legal theory as expounded by Kelsen. Radical oversimplification. And radically oversimplified conceptions of what it is to define law and what it is to identify as our subject matter. Hart pulled us a long way from that, and his successors have travelled a great deal further and have met up, I think, with the mainstream of legal theory which originated in those dialogues of Plato.